Do you want to learn more on how to put money to work in regenerative food and agriculture? Follow our video course via investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the links below. Now, on to the podcast. How do we sell the full rotation from an arable farm or all the products coming from an advanced agroforestry system? Diversified farms are amazing, but how do we sell all of that if you're not going to a small local farmers market? What is the role of technology and platforms and predictive software? Learn more about a company doing just that and selling to more than 10,000 customers in Switzerland. Welcome to another episode of Investing in Regenerative Agriculture, Investing as if the Planet Mattered, a podcast show where I talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why am I focused on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land, grow our food, and what we eat. And it's time that we, as investors, big and small, and consumers, start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. In March last year, we launched our membership community to make it easy for fans to support our work. And so many of you have joined as a member. We've launched different types of benefits, exclusive content, Q&A webinars with former guests, Ask Me Anything sessions, plus so much more to come in the future. For more information on the different tiers, benefits, and how to become a member, check gumroad.com/investingregionag or find the link below. Thank you. So welcome to another episode today with the co-founder of CrowdContainer. Welcome, Tobias.
Hi, Koen. Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
To start with, the personal question I always love to ask, how did you end up working on soil? Because if I'm not mistaken, you weren't born on a farm.
Yeah, that's right. I was born in a small farmer village. At the time, it was still pretty much a farmer village. Now it's changing. I've always been interested in food, but I really started thinking more about soil when I, like at the beginning of the last decade, when I was working in wholesale trade, selling a lot of certified product or organic certified, fair trade certified, all kinds of certification. And I realized that people who are really working with the soil, who are on their farms, having very diversified production system that care for the soil, they have a huge structural disadvantage in selling their produce. And when I realized that, I thought that's really something is going wrong there. And I started also thinking what can be done about it.
And what is that structural disadvantage? I mean, I can come up with a few, like you're probably producing different kind of products and the quantities are smaller, or you put in a lot of effort and maybe extra costs. What is the main structural disadvantage that puts you against the system as we now know it, the anonymized commodity system we've built over the last year?
Yeah, sure. So basically what happens is that we have this retail system with big supermarket retailers where we most of us buy our food. And what you find on the supermarket shelf, as you said, is anonymized commodities, basically food that has a certain shape, a very clearly predefined shape, and that the supermarket makes sure that he has never an empty shelf space, because he can source that same type of food from many different places. Now, what happens if you diversify your production system and you start growing different varieties, different kind of crops? You get, as you said, smaller quantities, but you also get a different kind of food with different qualities that is often higher quality food, but you don't fit that small shelf space anymore. So that's the biggest problem that I experienced in many different ways with many different products by trying to sell to supermarkets, that in the end, it would not exactly match that specification of the commodity.
So let's say it seems to be that the supermarket or the supermarket shelf is the issue. Then what is the solution, or what is a solution that you've, of course, been working on and experimenting with because you've done a lot of pilots? What was the first solution you tried that maybe didn't work or did work? I don't know what was the first pilot like, but what was the first version or the first attempt of CrowdContainer?
Well, when I was still working in wholesale trade, of course, I did also many trials and trying to work in very close partnership with supermarkets, trying to find my own shelf space. Nothing really worked out. And so I thought in the end, I have to get direct access to the end consumer, because just looking at myself, I formed this hypothesis that, you know, that really tasty pepper, for instance, that doesn't have to really the right size to enter the supermarket shelf, that that could be something that could also be interesting for other end consumers, and that they also might appreciate the whole story of how this pepper is grown, why the variety is different, why it tastes different, why it looks different, that that might be something that is attractive for the end consumer, but not really attractive for a supermarket buying commodities. And that's where actually the idea of Crowd Container was born. That's also where the name is coming from, that the first pilot we did was just to put online a box full of spices and cashew nuts and coconut from some mixed crop agroforestry farms in the south of India, in Kerala. And we were proposing this to people via a crowdfunding platform here in Switzerland and just seeing whether there is a demand for it.
And you picked very deliberately a mixed forest or a mixed agroforestry system, so different products. You weren't selling just the coconut oil or just the coconut or just the spices. And were you already explaining that story? Like, look, if you want more trees to be in agriculture systems, it's called agroforestry. And that means they're going to be different trees together because we don't want a monoculture there, which means we need different spices, etc. Or we're just selling, like, these are very high-end, very tasty spices and some other things together, like this is a nice box to have? Or what was the storytelling there when you did the crowdfunding?
Yeah, of course, we deliberately picked really that whole, the big variety that you have on that field. We cannot do everything because some produce is being consumed locally, which is also very nice. But everything that can basically be exported, non-perishables, we put it in that box and we really positioned it in a way to say, this is, you know, what that forest can give you instead of just cashew nuts.
And how was the response? How did people respond to cashew plus a lot more?
Yeah, we were quite surprised. Like in the beginning, it was a bit like the beginning of the crowdfunding was according to our expectations. We were on track, everything fine, but not really, you know, nothing crazy. And then there was some sort of a turning point where the media came in, where some people, like influencers, picked up that story and said, wow, but that's amazing. That is really true. That is coming from 1 hectare of land, all these different broad. That's so amazing. And then the media came in and bigger media came in and we were completely like overrun by by these orders, or actually crowdfunding contributions, which we had to compensate with this mixed box full of stuff.
How many boxes did you pre-sale sell, basically?
Yeah, it was at that time, it was something more than 500, but it was big boxes. It was each box €150. So, wow. Yeah.
And so you felt there was something. Something was there. People didn't only want a box for a good value, but they were also interested in that 1 hectare or one piece of an agroforestry system can get all of this. Like something was clicking there with the media and influencers, etc. So what was, apart from shipping all these boxes, what was the next step?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, as you said, shipping the boxes for me was a big thing, no? Because I always, I just traded big like standard containers filled with one product, no? And so when it turned, you know, from kind of asking people to support your crowdfunding to, you know, so the demand is just coming in and the crowdfunding is ending and people are still asking whether they can still get one of these boxes. And we had to say, no, now it's closed. And, you know, we were like, now we have to bring that stuff to Switzerland. And will it pass? Will it pass customs? Will it comply with all the regulations? All that stuff, no? Because it's not the standardized food that you usually find and import. So the first or the next step was really to make sure that everything is in line with regulation, that customs are sorted out. And actually, it was easier than I expected. I thought that now, you know, probably the big problems start. But then I realized again that a lot of, you know, the requirements that I had with buyers, this 12-page specification sheet, a lot of that was actually, you know, the I don't know, the packaging size or a machine of the supermarket that needed that specification and not really legal requirements. So we imported that container. We made a big party when it arrived and had 400 or 500 people come there and pick up their boxes. Yeah, it has been quite amazing.
And the boxes were already packed in with the farmer co-op in India, or you were packing it when the container opened in Zurich?
No, at the time it was packed at origin, at source.
Which saved a lot of time probably on your end, yeah.
Yeah, which otherwise this arrival party wouldn't have been possible.
Would have been a packing party.
Yeah, I mean, today we don't have, do arrival parties anymore. And many people ask for it because it's still in their mind as this crowd container experience. And it's for that reason we can't do it. We have to do picking here in Switzerland.
And so then 500 people and more, because maybe many took it together with friends, etc., were super happy. And you could go back to your normal day job. But you didn't. What was the next step?
Yeah, many people challenged me then. I said, look, this can work. And people said, no, come on, Tobias, this is only because you have been there in India and you know these guys and it's your relation to them. And that's a really special case. I don't think that exists anywhere else. And that somehow for me, it really motivated me to figure out whether this is now really a special story with this agroforestry in Kerala and my relation to that, or whether it is something that really, whether it's really that structural as I imagined it to be. So we did another 4 crowdfundings with different origins, different countries. We imported coffee from agroforestry, coffee from Peru. We imported some stuff from Italy. We started working with some Swiss farmers. And each time that proved true that basically, yeah, people are interested in that type of product and that we can also deliver it.
And so there was really one off, like you were selling a box of coffee plus other things, I'm imagining, and turning that from a, let's say, a crowdfunding machine or a crowdfunding campaign machine into a company, I can imagine is quite a step. What was the turning point there? You said after 4, because you could have gone on, do number 5 and 6 and 7 and what was the moment you said, okay, we need to turn this into something more than just opening parties for containers and into something more structured?
Yeah, there were several constraints in that model, no? One very, you know, from the customer side, it was clear that once you have one of those boxes with all that stuff inside, that you soon might need more pepper, but not more cloth, for instance, and that you don't want to order another box. But on a crowdfunding page, you cannot really implement a real web shop where you can choose what you want to have. And that made that it was hard, you know, it was easy to convince new people, but it was hard for the really convinced customers to reorder, which of course was something we had to fix also because we always wanted to work in very close partnerships with the farmers and not kind of jump from one sourcing partner to the next one, because that wouldn't help them in the way they produce. Then also we had a little bit of legal constraints in terms of, we started this with an association and the association made quite a big turnover with its crowdfunding. So of course authorities started also asking some questions. What it really is. So we.
What are you actually importing? Yeah.
Yeah. What we do as an association here, how commercial it is, also in terms of you have to register with food authorities and all that stuff. So it became pretty clear that we have to incorporate by 2017. Yeah. Second half of 2017, it became very clear that we have to incorporate. And for me, it was clear at that point that we want to do the two steps together. We want to incorporate and then build our own platform to run this properly and also in a way that people can really become regular customers.
And there, I wouldn't say you become an online supermarket, but you're going in the direction of unbundling again the bundle you've built for that one piece of forest or that one piece of the farm. So what was the first products you put on, or how did that transition from the campaigning every couple of months another box to you can actually order individual things, or you can, how did you unbundle that? How did people respond? Because they were used to this campaigning piece as well, I'm imagining.
Yeah, so I always had this idea in my mind, and it's still somehow there when I developed this idea of crowd containers when I was still working with wholesale trade, that somehow, this once you accelerate this campaigning and accelerate it more and more, it's somehow slowly the difference between normal shopping and campaign shopping, kind of, or pre-ordering will get blurred more and more, and it can become more and more convenient for end consumers to take part in campaigns or sales campaigns without even feeling that it is really a sales campaign, because it starts overlapping and you have a bigger number of people, so you have a bigger spread of what kind of products are ordered. And so we did just the first step in that direction by, first of all, as you said, unbundling the box and just offering the same products separately and see what the demand for the individual products was. But still, of course, by putting it online in one shop from one region, all these products, giving that context that they grow all together, and asking people to buy a box which is customized for their needs, still we sold a lot of each product.
And so what is, now we're in 2021, what has Crowd Container morphed into? What is it currently? If I would go to the website, I definitely put the link below. It is in German, so you will need Google Translate if you don't speak German, but you will get a good idea. What is it currently offering? And then we'll get to talk about the future, obviously.
So currently you find offerings from five different origins. One is Switzerland. We work with around 20 farms here in Switzerland. Then Sicily, where we work with two farmer cooperatives. There is these products from India we were talking about. There is still the coffee from Peru. And there is newly also some products from Spain. And you would have regular crowd ordering. So it's still based on this idea that we collect orders. It's pre-sold basically. And we import and send you whatever has been ordered. What you find on the website for each product is a very big amount of transparency information, including cost transparency. Because you pre-order it, you get really that right to a full transparency, because no one is speculating with that food in between the producers and us. So you get the price split, who gets what for each
Wow.
product.
And then it arrives on my doorstep, or there's still some kind of party when I can go and pick it up, or both? Because it's mostly Zurich, it's a number of cities in Switzerland, let's just be very clear. And how does it work to end up being on my plate?
Yeah, so we operate in the whole of Switzerland. You can order food from anywhere. The non-perishable products are delivered in a box from the Swiss Postal Service. They have a very nice yellow box which they take back, which is a circular system, and we choose that because it's the most sustainable delivery option at the moment. And you can do this from anywhere in Switzerland. The fresh products, they have currently a separate logistics, and you have to pick it up. We partner with another shop, and they have shops in each like bigger cities. There are no real big cities here in Switzerland, but in each bigger city, you have a pickup point where you can pick up, for instance, fresh mangoes from Spain.
Wow. Yeah. So it's a mix of fruit, the mangoes, and of course the coffee, and I'm imagining all the tomato-like products and the nuts, etc., from Sicily, the whole cashew nut and all the spices from India. So you get pretty far. I mean, not all your daily stuff, but quite a nice variety of things you would anyway buy in the supermarket without any price transparency, and obviously completely different quality. And in terms of prices, both for the customers, for the end consumers, and for the farmers, what are the big differences there compared to buying in the supermarket? Like, am I spending twice as much, or compared to organic, where am I more or less? Depends obviously on the product in terms of pricing. And then what does it mean for the farmers to sell with you?
Yeah, on the farmer side, we have tried to calculate it to compare it to commodity prices, which is, of course, comparing apple and pears. But still, we did it. And on an average, we pay 2.7 times the commodity price to farmers. For the consumer, this means it can vary quite a lot depending on the product. It's very hard to compare to what you get in the supermarket. But if you get similar products at some small shops, that is possible, no? Or also on a farmer's market, you can find sometimes similar products. In the small shop, they cost you more than if you buy it from us.
So if you go for the, let's say, the higher-end fair trade specialistic small shops in the larger cities, you would pay more.
Or like gourmet shop, whatever, yeah.
And in this case, it gets even on your doorstep, which helps, obviously. So that's currently, you have how many customers or regular customers do you have interacting with the platform? Of course, some order large quantities, some order maybe less. But as it is a crowd place, I mean, it gets bundled. But just to give a sense of scale, how many people are interacting on the Swiss side of things as a customer?
Yeah, currently we are at almost 10,000 paying customers.
Which is a lot.
And of course, there is a lot of variation in that group. Like, you have maybe 20% of them really regular customers ordering every month or even several times per month. And then you have people who are one-offs, and you have also a lot of people because, I mean, fortunately, I can tell that we are growing quite fast at the moment. So that also gives you a lot of people who have just managed to buy the first time, and we don't know yet whether they will develop into a regular customer or whether they will...
They're a recent cohort, yeah. And what does... Because you have a very specific... I mean, we've known each other for a bit. Very specific view on what the role of crowd container will be or could be in the future for regenerative agriculture. Can you let us have a look into the future? Where do you want crowd container evolve into, or what would you like it to be in, let's say, a couple of years? Could be much longer, but not next month. But in an ideal world, what would crowd container do for both the customers and obviously for the farm and the farmers, the cooperatives, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, from what I experienced, we are really still committed and have that vision of creating a distribution model that is tailored to the needs of really diversified regenerative agriculture, which I think is very much needed to make regenerative agriculture a business model for the farmers as well, a real business case, and to bring in young people into farming, make it interesting for them, and then also to attract investment. I think there is still a lot to be done also in terms of technology, adapt technology for the farms in a way that it can really be used in this kind of mixed crop setup. There's still a long way to go. And I think in our view, really that distribution piece has to be put in place to make that transition work, because of course now there is a lot of things going on the farms, but I hear again and again that many times, even though you can increase your yields, you can increase the quality you grow, but that doesn't always mean that you can easily sell your stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a point we need to talk more on this podcast, and hopefully we will over the next months and years. Like, how do we actually sell? It makes things coming from forestry systems, agroforestry systems, but also arable, it's not going to be, pretty sure it's not going to be monocultures, which means we need ways to sell cover crops that might be super an amazing ingredient in something. And we need that layer on top of the farm or beyond the farm gate that is able to sell, to distribute, to reach the end consumer with the right Facebook ad, to use the right storytelling, to which is not the job of the farmer. Some are amazing at it, but they have a lot to figure out on the farm, and we need to disrupt the, I wouldn't say even the supermarket, but figure out a way to get these very diverse, which is very difficult. I mean, logistic wise, mixing mangoes and coffee is, as you know much better than I do, very complex. So do you really see that digital layer, that layer of connecting there, the city, obviously, as with the countryside and explaining the diversity, is that enough? Or does it really need to go to a next level with the pickup points and the shipping and make it as convenient as possible? What's your feeling there? How far do we need to go to make it as convenient as walking into a supermarket at 5:30 or 6:30 and take something from the shelf?
Yeah, I think we have to work on both ends. On one side, you have really the operational side, where we have also learned in the last 3 or 5 years of prototyping that a certain kind of convenience will be required. And we think we know how to work on it. We already started to work now with demand forecasting, and we will slowly replace this crowd ordering model by more forecast model, which is of course feasible only if you have quite a large number of customers, but we are closely getting to a...
What do you mean by a forecasting model? What would that mean in practice?
That would mean in practice, for instance, right now, where we have already started is that we have a shipment from Sicily every month. And until last year, we always waited for the order to be sent for the, like we did the sales campaign, finished the sales campaign, sent the order. And now we can already send the order. We can already anticipate what will be sold like at the beginning of the campaign. In the future, even more in the future, we will be able to send the order before the stuff is sold and still be reasonably sure that 98% is actually really will be sold like this. And then comes this combination of mango and coffee, no? Because at that point, we will be able to have some olive oil with us that we know that we are going to sell it in the next month, and we can ship it together with the fresh mango when the mango is ripe. So that's a piece of convenience that we will slowly add, like we did the unbundling of the boxes. And we can do it by building up that really large number of end customers who are regularly ordering from us.
And you take on then, of course, a bit of the risk of storing potentially quite a few mangoes or quite a few olive oil bottles that you might not sell. You know you will probably, so that gets... I mean, that will be interesting, but of course, that also means it's much faster. So I'm still taking part of a crowd campaign, but if I order and it closes, like it might already be in Switzerland. So it can be delivered much faster than now when I maybe have to wait until it closes and then it gets shipped. And then, I mean, if it's spices from India, it can take a while, obviously. So also the speed there comes bigger, but you take a bit of risk, but should be compensated by the amount of people you have ordering in general.
Of course, you could still argue now that we are becoming like the supermarket. So I think just to show you a bit more like how that vision could look like. So every week you get this availability, the available products from our partners. You can decide what you want to do, what kind of a weekly order. And the order will be based on the perishable product, on the fresh product, which has to come directly from the farm because everything else doesn't make sense. But based on all the data we have, we know that, so many people will order some olive oil together with the mango, which of course also makes it worth delivering it to your home. And that will be feasible because we, compared to the supermarket, we will really base all that supply chain management on the data that we have from our end customers, and we will pass it through the supply chain till the producer, no? So even the producer gets access to that data and can plan accordingly. What happens at the supermarket? Of course, the supermarket also collects all that data and they have many more customers and much more accurate data projections, but it stops at the marketing. They will use it to do a better marketing for their customers. But then behind you have this sort of like pyramid system of traders, one middleman who is handing the product onto the others, and they make sure that whatever the supermarket needs is available. And that's where it becomes not feasible or unsustainable for a diversified farm. So we will create a model which is based on data, but where the data is passed on through the supply chain up to the producer.
And would you see then you starting a conversation with the producer as well to diversify the farm or to maybe introduce crops that you know you can sell or products that you know you see a demand from? Like, how far do you see that conversation going? Is it going to be a one-way street, just feeding information? Look, next year we'll need X bottles or X jars or X mangoes. Or actually, if you would introduce YZ with your rotation or in your first year system, we actually have a market for it because we know this. How close do you see those things? Will it be a one-way street or actually a conversation?
It already happens from both sides. So for instance, our partners in Sicily, they tell us, yeah, it would be better for our crop rotation system if we include topinambur or something like this. Do you think you have a market for this? So we try to see if we have sold a similar product and we try to, of course, make a forecast.
I don't think there's a similar product than Rhizotopiumbu. It's quite Jerusalem artichoke, just for other
reasons. Artichokes, yeah, maybe.
It's quite a specific.
They make a paste out of it. That's a real case. So they make a paste out of it. So we have compared it to certain pestos and certain kind of sauces that we offer, and we told them, yeah, okay, probably there will be a demand, probably we can sell so and so much of this. So they did a test and then we sold it and it worked out well. So now they have been able to include that into their crop rotation. That is happening all the time.
Which a supermarket would never, ever even imagine. It's not even in their vocabulary to suggest something like that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, there is the other way around. It's like you figure out that topinambur is a very hip thing to eat at the moment. So you will look for a trader who can offer topinambur in the right quality. And then you look for another two to make sure that you get always supply, and where it ends up in terms of production, you have no clue. And of course, at the moment, this is still on a very, you know, we talk a lot together and try to figure out what will work. And I'm sure that in the future, this will be much more data-based, because we see it with products, for instance, tomato sauce, passata, is turning really fast. And there we only talk about numbers, you know. There you already see that you have the data, you have the certainty, how much you can sell. And farmers are asking, what would you forecast based on the past sales numbers?
Yeah, which is an amazing discussion to have, because they can plan for next year and potentially next year's. And of course, their rotation might change where to put the tomatoes and the topinambur, etc.
Exactly. So our vision is really, you know, in the end, we will have a system where the farmer can access some sort of backend and put in, yeah, if I would grow barley next year, how much could I sell through the crowd container channel? And the system will give him, you know, a number with a certain level of uncertainty and will say, okay, 90% sure you can sell that many tons of barley.
For this and this price. Yeah. And then you can decide if it's worth the risk to engage in that.
Yeah. Or rather the other way around, in terms of pricing, the farmer puts the price that he needs to grow it in a way which is sustainable for him. And then based on that, our engine will tell him how much he can sell with that price.
That makes more sense. How long do you envision before a system like that? I mean, that complex, but is it years from now? Is it something you're already building? Is it 10 plus years? What do you feel from what you've seen going from the individual pilots to a much more structured and fluid system at the moment? But this, of course, what you pictured now is a few steps further. What do you envision there? Is it something we can talk about 12 months from now? Is it a few years?
We want to fully replace this crowd ordering model by a prognostic model in the next 3 years. Then it will not be based on, you know, crazy artificial intelligence with a lot of metadata. Hopefully that will come further down the road, but within the next 3 years, with statistical models, maybe with some bringing in some first easy to handle metadata like calendar and stuff like this, we are already testing that. We will be able to replace it with a prognostic model and hopefully then refine the prognostic model step by step until we can do a yearly planning with the farmers based on that prognostic model, which will probably take another 2-3 years.
That's super interesting.
So, but it's not, I mean, the technology is there. We are testing it with some individual pilot. It works both for farmers and for consumers and for us also. I mean, this pre-ordering, or, you know, the earlier ordering of the stuff from Italy hasn't really increased our risk a lot. We know what we are going to sell. So we feel pretty sure that this can become reality.
And switching gears a bit, and a few questions I always like to ask on the investing side of things. You are fundraising. You have been talking to a lot of impact investors in Europe. Probably, I wouldn't say all of them, but many. What have you seen? Like, is there, compared to 3-4 years ago, or 4 years ago, actually, when you started, or five even, is there more interest? And what do you feel like is missing? Are investors actually getting interested in that layer off the farm? Or is it still a lot of discussion on ag tech and land buying and regenerating in the region ag and food space? What do you see when you talk to investors that are reaching out to you, or you reach out to them, obviously, discussing the food system?
Yeah, as you said, we are currently fundraising and we are close to closing the actual round. And this would not have happened, I think, 10 years ago, because when I was still working in that other company, in the trading company, discussions were far away from that. We were already also engaged with the impact investment funds. And I think it has changed quite a bit. The understanding of, the systemic importance of the food system, and that to understand it and also to really, see it as an investment opportunity, that kind of understanding has not been there. At that time, it was purely like, is it really fair trade what you're doing, or is it organic? I'm more from this fair trade space, so I invest in that. How much premium do the farmers get? But a more systemic view is definitely something that is coming up that we are feeling.
And what would you do if you would be in charge of a large investment fund? Let's say, I don't know how much it exactly is. I think it's quite close to the euro. 1 billion Swiss franc. You'll be an investor tomorrow. You have a very long view if you want to, or a very short one. Could also be the case. Apart from obviously closing the fundraising round of CrowdContainer. But what would you focus the rest of an investment fund that size on if you had free range of choosing in the food and ag space? How would you put that to work?
I think in the beginning, as a first step, it would be very important still to invest in consumer awareness, to really find smart projects that are investable, form the sort of awareness on both ecological and health aspects of food. On the other hand, on the production side, I already mentioned that I think there is a lot to be done to create lighter and smarter equipment that really helps diversified farms.
And cheaper ones.
And cheaper ones, of course, also. And you need a certain scale to build, cheaper and then smart and light equipment.
It's not the sexiest part of the sector, but equipment is something I keep hearing as well. Like, we need to reinvent everything around a tractor you possibly imagine, everything around all the harvesting equipment, the processing equipment, the simply weeding equipment. I mean, there's such an amount of innovation needed there that it's a huge, not a very sexy, but a huge opportunity.
Yeah, but I think first the farmer needs to be sure that there is a demand for this type of products. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to invest in it.
So on the consumer awareness side, what would you focus on? You said health and ecology. What would be the main, if you had, this is definitely stolen from Tim Ferriss, but the huge billboard in San Francisco where I don't know how many people, or a gigantic billboard somewhere where, I don't know, a billion people pass by. What would you put on it? Like, what would be your focus point on ecology and health to get many more consumers interested in like looking at food differently, not just at feed, but actually at food?
That growing really matters. I think is a lot of misperceptions around, that packaging or transportation are the most important parts. And you can consult any life cycle assessment of food and you see that growing that food is really the paramount part of the footprint of a product. And that's both in ecological terms, it goes far beyond CO2, but also on the social side, so many people involved into growing a product, and the packaging bit or the transportation are just very small parts of it. So I think that's something that people have to understand, that how you grow it, it will fundamentally impact the ecosystems and the people, but it will also fundamentally impact you as a person. Like, what are you really eating there? It really makes a huge difference.
And it's such a complex story. How would you get that to the masses? How would you, maybe you don't have an answer to that, but how would you spend that billion or invest that billion or a similar size amount to get the masses to understand? Also, if you are living below the poverty line, if you are rushing through a supermarket to get something quick on the table for your children and you're juggling two or three jobs, like, how do you get people to see the importance of food and the growing part of it?
I think there are two sides to that. I mean, one thing is we are currently prototyping how to make, how to create that sort of awareness or understanding. And we work a lot with storytelling, but we also work a lot with communities. So we kind of use communities or try to involve communities to really spread that message. And that's much more efficient than just doing online ads. On the other hand, it's a very important thing that you mentioned that, you know, people below poverty line or people who have just so many things in their daily life that they will just not be able to focus on it. And I'm quite sure there is also some policy part to it. So I think when you think about really the fundamental transition that the food system has to go through, there has to be this like businesses and market actors, but there's also a policy part. And for me, if I had this like magic wand to change something now...
You're stealing my next question, but go ahead. Yeah.
Then I would really introduce a policy that makes sure that true cost accounting is applied across the whole value chains. And that at the end, when you buy a product, you really pay a price that somehow has internalized all these externalities. And that is not only negative externalities, but also positive ones like health. No, by eating healthy food, you get prevented from getting ill. And thereby, for instance, the state can save some health costs. No, so it's very important that both sides are calculated or factored into that true cost. And that will also make healthy food much more affordable.
Eating against disease. Yeah. No, it's, I think the policy piece we haven't focused a lot on in the podcast. We should do it more. I just find it very difficult to grasp what's the role of investors and food companies. But I think lobbying there is just as important as the fossil fuel industry and honestly the extractive food and agriculture industry is very good at. And we need to, just as we need to learn how to use the tool finance and money in the sector, we also need to use the learn how to use the tool lobbying, because that's potentially the biggest lever we have. Like the moment you change certain policies, and many farmers are doing many things that aren't even allowed in their region, like they're mixing cropping systems, they're integrating animals with olive trees, which in many places is not even allowed for good reasons, because we created an industrial ag system where that was very dangerous. But these are the pioneers that are doing everything that isn't officially legal, but creating the most amazing food and having all these positive externalities. So something has to change there. But yeah, who has the time to lobby and who has the resources to lobby in Brussels, in Washington, in New Delhi, in anywhere where power resides to change those policies? That's going to be a big question, I think, the years to come, especially in Europe, as the next gap is coming up in 4 or 5 years. And of course, the Farm Bill in the US has an enormous impact as well, where levers are changed, and not something we cover very often on the podcast, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the role of business is really to show that it is possible, that it is feasible, that there is also a demand, that there are consumers who understand it and who want it. And you can criticize a lot, you know, what is happening in the organic space, but they definitely had a big impact also on policies. By just showing that it is technically possible to grow a crop without using, chemical fertilizer and that has triggered a lot of policies also. And I think that's a role model also for what we are doing, by just showing what is possible, showing that it is also an attractive choice. And then, you know, the lobbying can really kick in and change things. If there is nothing there or nothing visible, you will not be able to lobby. And that's also why this lobbying for a thing that is already there is always much easier to defend the status quo, no?
And you have potentially, in this case, 10,000, but in a few years, 100,000 people that you can mobilize and push and sign and potentially get on the street, etc. Because yeah, you need large movements to change policies and to push policies as well. So it's something I hope to do more interviews on that, even though it's not the core part of this podcast.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm also very interested in that question. I mean, often it is also played one thing against the other. Should business solve it or should politics solve it? And I don't see it like this. My theory of change is really that business shows what is feasible, that the pioneers really make things possible. And then we need some policies which make it also accessible for all groups of the population.
Yeah, we've seen that with renewable energy, which is by no means perfect, but has done really came out of a few pioneers that spent way too much money for their solar panels at the beginning and brought down the cost curve. And obviously with all the issues on production side, but really showed that it's an alternative. Then policies followed, partly first in Germany that really kickstarted a lot, and then many followed. And now it's an industry that moves ahead, still is going too slow. We need many more smart grids, better storage solutions, better recycling and all of that. But it's an unstoppable force. Like, it keeps going because it was started by a few pioneers that paid and some policies and then a lot of very, very, very hard work. And I feel like we're at the beginning of that. I hope we go faster than that one. But to end with a final question, what do you believe to be true about agriculture, about regenerative agriculture that others don't? Like, where are you contrarian? Which is definitely a question inspired by John Kemp. He usually asks a similar question on his podcast.
I think it relates to what we have been talking about, policy also. I see in regenerative agriculture really a force that can unite and be very inclusive. I feel it can, somehow help to bridge the gaps between conventional farming and organic farming, between movements like the biodynamic movement and the agroecological movement. I think the worst thing we could do would be to, become another small group, small movement that says that we have the only truth. But I really see that it is very deeply rooted in the regenerative movement, that there is this openness and inclusiveness and that respect also for the individuality of each production system, of each farm. And I hope that we can extend this also and really with that, really unite these forces to make a transition of the food system possible.
And with that, I want to thank you so much for showing up in a very, very busy time, and not only logistically, but fundraising as well and many other things, and sharing your story until now and the story of Card Container. I'm very much looking forward to checking in and following it over time.
Thank you so much, Koen.
If you found the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast valuable, there are a few simple ways you can use to support it. Number one, rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. That's the best way for other listeners to find the podcast, and it only takes a few seconds. Number two, share this podcast on social media or email it to your friends and colleagues. Number three, if this podcast has been of value to you and if you have the means, please join my membership community to help grow this platform and allow me to take it further. You can find all the details on gumroad.com/investingregionag or in the description below. Thank you so much and see you at the next podcast. Dear friends of the podcast, I'm super excited to share with you the online video course Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food, how to put money to work in regenerating soils at scale and growing a lot of tasty food while doing it. Why are we doing this course? After 100 interviews and more than 100 hours of audio asking the question how to put money to work in regenerating soils, and I've been following the space since 2011 and recording these podcasts since 2016, we thought it was time to share our lessons learned. What have we seen in this space over the last years? How have we built our decision-making framework? What to focus on with the podcast? How have we picked interviewees? And what questions should you ask? What is happening in this space? What should you read? What should you listen? What should you watch? How to approach this space? For whom is this course? You, the soy builders and investors in this space. The soy builders, people working in this space, entrepreneurial farmers, fund managers, vehicle builders, crowd investing, platform builders, ag tech companies, farm to gut food companies, permaculture, keyline designers, holistic management consultants, etc., etc. People that are building soil at scale. And the investors who are putting their own money to work through their family office or as private individuals, or people who are putting other people's money to work through foundations, institutional capital, banks, insurance companies, etc. Is this course free? No. This is pay what you think it's worth. Meaning, I have no way of knowing what this course will be worth to you. And I'm very aware that among the listeners of this podcast, we have people with very different means. So I'm inviting you, if this course is creating value to you, and if you have the means, to consider paying what you think it's worth. Thank you. So what is this course? It's currently a series of 17 videos, mostly ranging from 10 to 15 minutes, plus PDF slides, so you don't have to ride along. We're going to look into why invest in regenerative agriculture and why extractive agriculture is so risky, how to invest, what kind of frameworks you could and I think should build, what to invest in, what kind of co-investors you could find, or what kind of investors you could find if you're a soil builder. Every lesson will have a digging deeper part where I will share what kind of reports, what kind of interviews, what kind of videos you can look into if you want to dig deeper. We're going to look at nutrient density, landscape design, and a lot more. So what is it not? It's not a list of investable deals. Unfortunately, that doesn't exist in this world. We're really at the beginning of the regenerative agriculture and food revolution. It's also not investment advice. Before making any investment, please find professional investment advice. So get ready, get a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, or whatever you're drinking. Click on the link below, sign up, and I'm really looking forward to your feedback.